From our studios in Cuenca, Spain, I'm Kate Jetmore with Listen. Today we continue our series on language. Our interviews take a deep dive into the various aspects of how we communicate, how we take an idea or feeling or message and transmit it to another human being. No matter what language you were raised in, language is the key to whether we understand one another or misunderstand one another. My guest today is José García. Born in 1976 in Cuenca, Spain, José started to learn English at the age of 10. He spent a month in the UK at the age of 17, later traveling to Ireland in 1996 while studying translation at university, and then again in 1998. He's been in contact with the English language ever since as a translator, interpreter, tourist officer, clerk for the EU, and currently as a teacher, but also due to his fondness for British and American folk music. José García, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I'm so glad you could be here today. You are in a very interesting position. You're a native Spanish speaker. You were born and raised in Spain, and you're fluent in English, but you're not truly bilingual because you didn't learn English in tandem with your mother tongue. This means you actually have memories of learning English, and there's a certain level of awareness there, and you're in a position to make observations about that process. Is there anything you can share with us about what you remember?
Well, yes, as far as I remember. Well, as you said, I started learning at the age of 10. Mm-hmm. This was, you know, quite early at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, nowadays, children start at about the age of, well, 3, 4.
Yeah, so, as soon as they start school.
So it was late compared with now.
Right.
But you know, I had to learn the grammar and many grammar issues. I still hadn't learned in Spanish. So it was a bit strange at first. And because of the fact that English is completely different to Spanish in terms of pronunciation and those things.
Right.
I was very grateful. It was nice that I could have a Scottish teacher who helped me a lot with pronunciation.
So you had the privilege of having a native English speaker as one of your earliest teachers. Mm-hmm. Do you see that as being key in the process of learning English?
Yeah, of course, of course.
Yeah. You know, that's not normally the case these days in Spain. I mean, I don't know what it's like in other countries, but in Spain, you yourself are a Spaniard teaching English. I mean, you currently make your living as a Spaniard teaching English. And I know that's certainly been my son's experience going to school. His teachers have never been native English speakers. How do you think that is playing out in Spain? I mean, I guess it comes down to the specific teacher.
Yeah.
Do you have any observations on that?
Yeah, the problem is about pronunciation. You know, not enough effort is being made in this sense. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, since most English teachers are not native, they are Spanish. And maybe they are not aware of the importance of pronunciation. Mm. I don't know. It's very difficult for us Spaniards to speak properly and even to distinguish some sounds.
To hear them.
Yeah.
That's really the first step, isn't it? I mean, if you can't hear the difference.
Yes.
I'll just give an example for some of our listeners who maybe aren't Spanish speakers or aren't familiar with the Spanish language or what those challenges would be for Spanish speakers. For example, in Spain, there is one, when you see the letter S,
yes,
it's pronounced one way. And that is one of the options in English, which is S. But we also have the option of Z, which would be like teachers, right? And then we also have, if you combine it with an H, then you're looking at sh.
Yes.
And neither of those two sounds exist in Spanish.
Yeah. And this is why teachers here should make an effort.
Yeah. Well, yeah, make an effort if they know that difference exists, right? But I guess the step that would come before that is to be made aware of it and then make an effort.
Yeah, well, I think the problem is usually with the vowels more than with the consonants.
Mm-hmm. Talk about that a little bit.
Since we only have 5 vowel sounds in Spanish, whereas in English you have like, I don't know, 12, 14?
I think more.
I haven't counted them.
I think it's more than 20.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, between the pure vowels and then the diphthongs and the triphthongs.
Yes.
So what are the vowel sounds in Spanish?
A, E, I, O, U.
And that's
just
it?
Just five. Yeah, and that's it.
And there are never any exceptions. If you see an A, it's A every time. Man. For our listeners who are looking for a foreign language that they might want to learn, that's pretty attractive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I also think for English speakers who've never studied another language, it's really eye-opening. Because, you know, when you speak your own language, you don't think about... You know, you learned it as a toddler. You don't think about how it might be tricky for other people until you yourself are studying another language, you know? So I think it's good to shed a little light on that, that English can be really tricky.
Yes.
It is really tricky. So I'd love to know, I mean, I'm guessing tricky might be one of the words that you would use talking about your experience, you know, evolving as a student of English to the point where you are now, the level that you have now of English. Talk us through that a little bit. You said you were 10 when you started studying. One of your teachers was from Scotland, so you were studying with a native
and
teacher.
And another thing that helped me a lot as well was the fact that I was a geek.
How so?
We have talked about that before, but, you know, I was interested in many things. For example, as a role player,
I loved role-play games?
Role-playing games, mm-hmm. Yeah, Dungeons and Dragons, that stuff, you know. So it happened that I might have been like 12 years old when I started playing role-playing games. And I played it together with some friends, and we would play Dungeons and Dragons up to level 3.
Okay.
Then we needed another book, which was still not translated into Spanish. So I told my father, who was on a business trip in Madrid, to go to a specialized shop to buy me the expert edition. And he told me, Jose, we have a problem. I found it, but it's only in English. And I said, okay, buy it. And he brought me it, and I had to translate it
for
my friends to play it. And I was only, I don't know, 13, 14 years old. So I translated my first book at the age of 14, maybe.
Did you translate the whole book?
Yeah, I translated the whole book because I was a geek. So,
but that is the definition of inspiration, isn't
it?
I mean, if you don't have something in front of you that drives you to, you know, make an effort, take the time, put in the work to make that text accessible for you and your friends. Because if you don't, you can't keep playing the game. Oh my gosh, wow. That's great.
Also with music, I would say music helped me a lot.
Because I
also loved British music, American music, mainly rock, but also folk music.
Mm-hmm.
And I started playing with a band when I was 15.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to play some, you know, American, British songs. And there was no internet then in Spain. So we had to learn the lyrics the hard way.
Mm-hmm.
This means by playing our radio cassette once and again and again and again until we got the lyrics or something.
Rewind.
Yeah. It was listening, practicing.
Yeah. But actually because you wanted to know.
Yeah.
Did your friends speak English too, or were you again sort of being the interpreter for the whole group?
Well, some of them did, particularly musicians. You know, there is a close relationship between music and languages. And so,
talk about that a little bit. What's that relationship that you've observed there or you've experienced there that reveals a close relationship between music and languages?
Well, music is just another language, you know. So I would say if you're interested in different languages, probably one of them will be music as well.
Mm.
And it is a fact that when I was studying my degree, I studied translation. There was a high percentage of classmates who could play one instrument or sing or were related to music somehow.
Do you think that has to do with your ear?
Yeah, certainly.
So it's mostly about listening, more about listening than producing language. Although, I mean, they're very much interrelated, wouldn't you say? Wow.
Yeah, listening and interpreting what you hear.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Wow. So go back to, you were sort of taking us through. Now we're up to, you're maybe 15 or 16. You're playing in a band. What instrument do you play?
I started with a piano.
Well,
the
really?
Keyboards. Yeah.
Okay.
This was my first instrument, but then I changed into the guitar. I knew you
played the guitar because, you know, you and I, as you know, you and I met through a musical project.
Yes.
We have a common friend who had an idea for a group. And so I'm a singer. He called me up. You're a guitar player. He called you up. He also plays the guitar. And so we played in the same, you know, we performed in the same group for a while. But you started with piano.
Yeah, I did.
And so this story you were telling us about, you know, figuring out the songs and taping them off the radio and then figuring out what the words meant, that at that point you were playing keyboards?
Yeah, yeah. That's okay. When it started.
Do you remember any of those songs were? The first songs that you were kind of...
I have a funny anecdote about an Australian song. You know the band R.E.M.?
What band?
R.E.M.
Oh, yeah, R.E.M.
Rapid Eye Movement, yeah. Mm-hmm. They have a song called This Is the End of the World as We Know
It.
Oh,
my gosh.
And it was a
nightmare.
Talk about a challenge. It was a nightmare. You know, we were trying to, you know, to guess the lyrics, and
yeah,
we couldn't because there were many words.
And it's so fast.
Yeah, so we talked to a woman who was a teacher at the official language school, and she told us, oh, okay, I will give it a go.
Okay.
She tried to, she guessed two or three more words, and then she told us, don't worry, because I have an Australian friend who is coming next week, so I'll play the song for her, and she will help us. And the Australian friend came and guessed some more words, but not all of them.
Yeah.
So you know what I did?
What?
I made them up. When we played them, I made them up.
Okay, and no one ever knew.
Yeah, even though there were some Americans there.
Yeah.
And I asked them about that, and they told me, well, we just didn't realize about it.
Oh, you revealed to them that you had made up the words?
Yeah.
Well, that sort of leads to another subject. I'm sure you've experienced this before, where you're listening to a song on the radio and singing along, and you're sure you know what the words are, and you're singing along at the top of your lungs, and then later you find out that for years you've been singing the wrong words.
Yes.
Has that ever happened to you?
Yes. But it also helped me distinguish some words, you know, with that very famous song by Joe Cocker, You Can Leave Your Hat On.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is how I learned the correct pronunciation of hat, because I would always say hat.
Right.
You know, and then I learned that
Spanish
a
accent.
Hat was a different thing, somewhere you live in.
Hut, not a hat.
Yeah.
Oh, how funny. Yeah, you can learn so much just by listening and noticing those details. And music is such a great way to do that. Because, it's interesting because as a music lover, it's hard for me to imagine people who wouldn't enjoy listening to music and learning through music. I guess there must be people out there who...
Yes, there are some, I can tell you.
Have you encountered them?
Yeah.
So you mentioned that your degree is in translation.
Yes.
Is that English or was it a different language?
Well, yeah, English was my second language. My first language, Spanish. Mm-hmm. And my third language was German.
Okay. So did you also work as a German translator?
No, not actually.
And, okay. Okay.
Yeah, I had to use German in one of my previous jobs, but I quickly forgot it.
Okay.
So
it's in there somewhere.
My German was never very good,
yeah,
I must say.
Yeah. Well, it's you and I were talking recently about sort of where your foreign languages are stored.
Yeah.
In your brain, that you've got sort of the one compartment that's dedicated to your mother tongue.
Yes.
And then, why don't you go ahead? Because you were the one who described it to me, actually.
Well, I don't know where I read it, but it seems that there is a compartment
yeah,
in your
An
brain
area.
For your native language, and another one for all the rest you learn, let's say acquired languages. So it happens when you learn a third language that there is some interference, not with your mother tongue, but with your first acquired language.
Mm, they interfere with each other.
Yeah, and this is why I probably pronounce German as if I were British, not Spanish. You know?
Yeah, which is totally counterintuitive. You would think a Spanish person who's learned German would speak German with a Spanish accent.
Yes.
But in your experience, it's with a British accent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you study translation. Where did you study translation?
In Soria.
In Soria, here in Spain.
Yeah, you know, it's a small town.
In the north, right?
Yeah.
That's a beautiful area. And currently, you're a teacher, right? Mm-hmm. You're teaching English here in Spain. You've talked a little bit about your experiences learning English. Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences teaching English?
Well, I started teaching at the age of 17, actually.
Did you?
Yes, I have
a
student.
How did that happen?
Well, my first student, because it was I think it was the son of a friend, my mother's friend or something like that. And he was, I was 17, he was 14, 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And he had some problem in passing his subjects, his English subject. So I helped him mainly with grammar.
Mm-hmm.
But not only with Brahma.
Mm-hmm. So the idea was to help someone who was having trouble passing his exams.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And did he pass?
Yeah. It was successful, yeah.
Did you enjoy that?
Yes, a lot. I liked it.
What is it that you like about teaching?
Sorry?
What is it that you like about teaching? What is it? Why do you feel attracted to teaching?
Well, the fact that I can see the result of my work,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I helped him.
I see
yeah, it
people
worked out.
Learn and even pass the subject.
Mm-hmm.
This is a wonderful feeling.
Yeah. Have you taught ever since? I
mean, yes. Well, ever since I have been teaching, not making my living from it
mm-hmm.
on a steady basis, but I started doing it like, 10 years ago, maybe,
okay.
when I was back in Cuenca.
Full time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Making my living from it, apart from translating.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is what I do now. I started like 10 years ago when my first child was going to be born.
Okay.
And I started as a private teacher mm-hmm. at home. And then I think it was like 4 or 5 years ago, a private center contacted me.
Okay.
And I've been working with them ever since.
So you teach in like an after-school language program.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. In Spain, they call it an academia.
Yeah, that's right.
And I guess there are morning classes there, but it's mainly for people who are busy all morning with
yes.
work or school, and then they come for classes in the evening. Wow, you've been there a long time, four or 5 years.
Yeah.
Anything you'd like to share with us about your experience in the classroom?
Well, it was completely different to what I had done before because, you know, when I was a private teacher, I was teaching one-to-one or
uh-huh.
maybe in groups of three, up to three people. So suddenly I was teaching 8, 9, 10 people
mm.
all together. I had done it before in some courses, but not on a steady basis.
And what's the big difference there that you end up having different levels in the same group?
Well, I would say the big difference is that you have to, you know, draw the attention, everyone's attention to the thing you are doing because it's very easy for some people to get distracted and
mm-hmm.
you have to be aware of everything and to make everyone involved in the class.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. there's sort of a phenomenon that I have observed here in Spain and I'm sure you have as well and I'd love to talk to you about it. That is that, you know, as we mentioned before, learners of English as a second language are as young as 3 years old here in Spain. Or people even take their babies to class, you know, before they even start preschool or school. And so on the one hand, it's like, oh, that's wonderful. You know, everyone must be fluent in English.
Yes.
But in fact, what happens is that people get very frustrated. There's this sort of accepted method, which in many cases doesn't work, and it's put into play year after year after year. And even the people who are most excited about learning English can get very bored and very frustrated. I think frustrated is a better word. Bored implies that things are working and you're advancing, but maybe not having fun.
Yes.
But frustrated implies that, you know, it's just not working. You know, you're not acquiring the language. You're not hitting the marks or passing the exams. But it doesn't have to be that way. Do you have? I'm curious what you have observed as a teacher of English, and if you have any advice for sort of how to bring a little sunlight back in or a little hope or a little spark back into the process.
Well, I think the best bit of advice I could give someone is enjoy it, mm-hmm. or at least try to enjoy mm-hmm. it. Because, you know, I have some students who write, when they begin with my classes, the first thing they tell me is, I don't like English. I just don't like it. So just me help pass the exam, and that's all.
And why are they there? Because they have to pass an exam either for
this
work
is why it's compulsory. So they have to.
Or maybe their parents are making them go to class.
Yeah. Okay. That happens, but maybe because of the system, you know, you need a certain level of English to get a degree. So this is
but
why.
But how do you? I mean, that's great advice. Yes, enjoy it. Like, have a good time. But how? I mean, how do you sort of bring that fun back into the process?
Yes, well, I try to make them aware that they can do many different activities in English. Listen to music. Mm-hmm. This is my chief weapon, I would say, is music. The problem is when someone doesn't like music.
Yeah.
Or they say things like, well, I just listen to Spanish music. Mm-hmm. And if someone only listens to flamenco, you know, it's going to be very difficult to find flamenco.
Flamenco in English, yeah. Good luck.
So this is a problem. But I would say it works with 90% of people.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, almost everyone likes music.
Do you use music in the classroom?
Yes, I do.
So you have some tried and true exercises that you've developed over the years and you bring them into the classroom. Yeah. Would you care to describe any of them?
Well, you know, the usual exercise in which you have to fill in the gaps to complete the lyrics.
Okay.
I think this is very useful. Mm-hmm. And I try to find songs that they like or, you know.
Do you update those songs or do you kind of go to the classics?
Well, now I'm starting to do it. Because,
to
you
update
know,
them.
In the past, there was no, let's say, generational gap.
Between you and your students?
Yeah.
And now there is?
But now there is. So the music we listen to is completely different. So this is why I'm asking them, what kind of music do you listen to? And which is your favorite singer? I try to update.
You know, I have really noticed something with the generation gap. But in my case, it's with translation. Mm-hmm. I teach a few English classes, but I mostly translate. And just over the past few years, and this is something that's very new for me, putting my finger on it, and it's been very disturbing. So let me describe it to you. I've translated several scripts for like TV shows, like a full season for an episodic TV show, that kind of thing. And so I'm sent the scripts in Spanish, and then I translate them into English. Well, a lot of them are the people in the show are much younger than me, and they're all using this very casual, slangy Spanish, which I understand, but I don't use, you know, at my age, I'm, you know, mid to late 40s, I don't use that kind of language. And I don't use it in English either. So here I am translating this very slangy, young, you know, kind of teenagery Spanish into what I remember as young teenagery English. But it's recently I realized that it's like late 80s.
And you know, it's different.
Slang. And I wonder, like, have I aged out of this particular job? I mean, I'm doing my best, you know, but you know, there is a generation gap there.
Yes, certainly. I remember the word mojo. Do you use that word?
Yeah.
And I asked a British friend about that word, like, I don't know, do you really use it? And he told me, well, maybe you would use it because you are over 40, but I would definitely not use it because I'm under 30.
Did he give you an alternative?
Oh, I don't remember. He told me it was something from the 90s.
Yeah.
And I answered, yes, I am from the 90s. Yeah. From the 90s.
Oh, he said mojo is from the 90s.
Yeah,
that's
mojo's
so
from
funny.
The 90s.
That's so funny. Oh my gosh. And after a certain point, it's like, well, do I really want to make an effort to update my slang? I guess in a certain sense you have to, or else you're going to have to pass on certain jobs. What about, you know, you talked about sort of bringing music into the classroom, bringing, you know, trying to get that spark back for people who might feel frustrated with the process. Do you have any other advice for any of our listeners out there who find themselves in the classroom, either as an English teacher or, you know, as a teacher of a different foreign language, what can we bring into the classroom to inspire our students?
Well, of course, apart from songs, mm-hmm. I try to make them read as much as possible and mm-hmm. try to find things that they are going to enjoy.
Yeah.
So if you like horror books, read about horror. Try to read as many different things as possible, but try to enjoy while you learn, because otherwise you will hate it and you know the learning process will be polluted somehow.
It sounds to me like, in addition to teaching English, you're also making an effort to teach people how to learn.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you see that in yourself? Is that something that you're doing consciously?
Half consciously, let's say. Yeah, but yeah, yeah, yeah.
Semi-consciously.
Yeah, I think, you know, there are many ways to teach and learn, many mm-hmm. different ways, and you have like the official standard ways, but I also try to make them aware that they can enjoy and have fun while they are doing something. This is the way I learned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I have the feeling that before going to university, I could already speak English and understand English and, you know, handle the language. But then I learned the rules, which are also useful.
Mm-hmm.
But before learning the rules, there were so many structures I could use because I had learned them by reading and listening to them. And,
yeah, they sounded familiar.
Yeah.
Right? They sounded right.
Yeah.
I remember being asked a question, you know, in the United States, in a school where everyone only spoke English, you know, kind of a normal elementary school. I remember being in language arts class, English class, and the teacher put, you know, some options before us, and I raised my hand and said, it's C, and I got it right. And then she said, why?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know why. And what came out of my mouth was, it sounds right. And then that's true. Okay, you got it right. It's good that you could rely on your gut instinct. The other option sounded wrong. But now let's talk about why it's right.
Yes.
You know, and that's where the structure comes in. But you're right. I mean, that's how we learn our mother tongue. It sounds right. My parents would never say it a different way. You know, you're imitating what you hear around you. And I think that kind of language learning, well, learning in general, but that kind of language learning just lays down really deep roots. And then you can go back and kind of figure out why.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Let's come back to music for a second. It's true that using music in the classroom can, you know, bring some fun in, and certainly for you as the teacher.
Also.
But what about music as a language, and what about the music of language? Can you talk about that a little bit?
What do you mean?
Well, I'm thinking about, I remember when I first moved to Spain, my Spanish wasn't really that good, and I would, you know, just kind of have the TV on in the background, or my husband, who was my boyfriend at the time, is his passion is cycling, so he would have, you know, the Tour de France on TV or something, and the announcers would say, Tour de Francia. And I remember, I had no idea what they were saying. My Spanish wasn't good enough. But what I was hearing was this like monotone, like,
yeah.
That's music.
Yes.
Those are tones that your ear hooks into. And I'm not saying that everyone speaks Spanish the way a sports announcer speaks Spanish, but that we do hook into those rhythms and the, you know, the speed of a language, the melody of a language.
Yeah, intonation.
Intonation. Yes, yeah. Can you talk about that a little bit?
But you mean in different languages?
Well, I mean, in your case, it would be, I guess, with English or with German. But I'm just, I'd love to hear your insights as far as, you know, how has that aspect of English or, you know, language learning come into your experience, or has it?
Well, I don't know. You mean about learning the English intonation?
Yeah.
And those things? Well, I would say you know, the intonation of English is very different to Spanish. Mm-hmm. I couldn't say Spanish is that monotone, you know, because this is the only way we can make some differences. For example, the difference between a statement and a question.
Okay.
Whereas in English, just by changing the word order, uh-huh, one can know whether you're asking or you're stating something.
Yeah, that's
but
true.
In Spanish, the only way to make the difference is by using the intonation.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that before. That's true.
But
yeah,
but yeah, but I would say the rhythm of the language is also very different. And mm-hmm, also, when, you know, related to music, I think it's very difficult, for example, to express something in, let's think about flamenco again.
Okay, please.
Like very Spanish. And to imagine singing flamenco in English.
Okay.
And vice versa. To me, you know, there's much rock music in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
But to me it sounds unnatural, because I would say the most natural way to sing a rock song would be English, because you know in English you usually make the stress at the end of the verses. Mm-hmm. And whereas
but
in Spanish,
not in Spanish.
No, in Spanish we usually the stress is usually in the last but one syllable. So
okay,
the
so
rhythm,
in the second
the
to
rhythm
last.
Changes a lot. Yeah.
Do you ever write music?
Yes, I do.
Have you played with that a little bit? I mean, have you, when you write music in Spanish, do you try to work with sort of pairing the music and the lyrics so that the emphasis falls on the second to last syllable?
Yes, the problem is my culture is mainly about British music.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I have like that rhythm deep inside.
Yeah. Does that mean that you tend to write lyrics in English?
This is why it's very difficult for me to write lyrics in Spanish.
Mm.
I've written some poetry in Spanish, mm-hmm, or drama, I don't know, but it's very difficult to write music lyrics in Spanish,
mm,
unless I have Spanish rhythm in my mind.
Mm.
And I usually come up with, let's say, English melodies.
Yeah.
So this is why I find it easier to write in English.
I think this might be a good place to segue. Before we finish our conversation, I wanted to talk a little bit about cultural interference.
Mm-hmm.
Can you define that term for our listeners?
Well, I would say it's something like not strictly related to when something not strictly related to language impedes communication.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm. That impedes communication.
Yeah, impedes.
So kind of, you know, people go into, you know, interpersonal relationships with their own experience. You're sort of enveloped in your own culture and your own experience. And everything that happens in that conversation or that interaction is seen through your own unique filter.
Yes.
Right? So, for example, my filter is, it has to do with being a native English speaker. I've acquired the Spanish language. I've lived in Spain for 18 years. Yours would be native Spanish speaker. You've acquired English. You also studied German, you know, currently living in Spain, but have traveled many times.
Yeah, all your background.
The UK. And you see this conversation that we're having through that lens.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it that happens when there's cultural interference in an interaction between two people? What is it that happens?
Where?
What is it that happens?
You know, when...
Or give us an example. I mean, maybe that would be the best way to come at it.
The last example, the last thing that happened to me, the last issue I had, it was like 2 years ago.
Okay.
I was introduced here in Spain. I was introduced to a girl from Glasgow.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, here in Spain, we usually kiss on both cheeks when we are introduced to one another. So this is what I did. And she was puzzled and surprised and... she had a blush on her face.
Yeah.
And I realized, well, that girl has probably not been to Spain before.
Yeah.
So she's not used to our customs, and she wasn't feeling well.
Yeah. Yeah. So
then I had to apologize, but you know.
Yeah. Just, because in her experience,
yeah,
that is kind of crossing a line, maybe a little bit too intimate. But for a Spaniard, it's just like shaking hands.
Yeah, and maybe, I don't know, maybe for an American girl, it would be different. I don't know, but she was British, so, you know.
Well, I've definitely witnessed that in the United States, because, you know, my husband is Spanish, and when he comes to the United States, you know, he does his best to kind of blend in, yeah. and, you know, he tries to take these issues into consideration, but every once in a while he'll, without thinking, he'll kiss someone on both cheeks and the other person will be like, whoa.
And it's not customary there.
It's not. No. Well, definitely not the way it is here. Yeah. I mean, here it's just like 100%
Yeah, like when you're introduced to someone new.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. you just, everyone does it. In the United States, I guess you find that sometimes, you know, I lived in New York for many years and definitely people would, you know, kiss each other on one cheek maybe, or sometimes two cheeks.
Yeah, but New Yorkers are different.
Yeah, it's kind of a different, it's not representative of the whole country. I wanted to bring up a situation that I'm sure you remember when you know, I hate to even bring this up because I don't feel like I contributed really to you learning English, but you did study with me for a little bit when you mm-hmm. were preparing for your C2 exam. And I remember you were sharing the class with another woman who was also preparing for the C2. So when we would meet, you were the man and then we were two women. And in one class, I can't quite remember if we were doing a speaking exercise or if you were just making a comment or if we were just saying goodbye or something, but you referred to us as ladies.
Oh, yeah. I think it was in writing, actually.
Was it? You had written it down? Okay. Yeah. I can't quite remember that. Do you remember the context?
Yes. I was talking about, I wanted to say old women and some issue they could have in a park with no bathroom service.
Ah, okay.
You remember that?
Yeah.
And I said, well, it might be a problem, particularly for old women.
Okay.
Because, you know, younger would have no problem
waiting.
Waiting or going elsewhere. But, and I used ladies instead of women, and you told me it sounded creepy. Yeah, and I didn't know that because, you know, to me, lady was like a very polite word. I wanted to be polite.
Well, it's something that I remember when that happened, and I remember feeling it on this very deep gut level. And probably with an English student of a lower level, I probably wouldn't have even brought it up.
Yeah,
but you know, because your grammar was fine. But here we were talking about a very specific nuance. And I thought, this is a person who is honing his English as finely as possible. And so I did bring it up and I said, you know, be careful with the word ladies, because it almost sounds like you're like the skeevy wannabe rapper or something.
I certainly am from that one. Yeah.
Exactly. That's the persona you're going for, skeevy rapper. That's so great. Well, is there anything else you want to add before we wrap up?
I don't know. Well...
So many things we could both ask.
You know, I need to be asked.
Well, I know one story I'd love you to tell, because we've had many conversations like this before. You were telling me about something that came up in the classroom. You were teaching the verb, the phrasal verb, to run out of
something. Yes.
I just want to tell our listeners, because, you know, there are people who listen to this podcast who haven't had the experience of learning a foreign language or haven't... you know, if English is their mother tongue, they're not aware that there are verbs in English. They're called phrasal verbs. And in other languages, they're expressed with one word. But in English, it takes like four or five words to express them. And one of them is to run out of.
Yes.
It means something very specific. So why don't you take it from there? Tell us that story.
You know, it's a problem when you just learn the meaning, but translate it into your own language. Mm-hmm. And translation is something very dangerous.
It's tricky.
Be something very dangerous, you know, because you're a translator.
Yeah.
So, it was get run out of.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was run out of. And after I explained the meaning, like when you are losing something you have, you lose something you have... I forgot to say gradually, or that there had to be an amount of something
that you kind of bit by bit are using.
Yeah. So that girl translated into Spanish as quedarse sin.
Mm-hmm.
So she asked me that question. So her boyfriend had just left her.
Mm-hmm.
And it was funny because she asked, "Can I run out of my boyfriend?" for example, because this is what has just happened to me.
Right, because that would make sense in Spanish.
Yeah, in Spanish it would make sense.
Quedado sin novio.
But it's not exactly the same. So I explained her, well, maybe if you have like 13 boyfriends and they were leaving you one after the other, you could use that expression, but this was not the case.
I've obviously run out of boyfriends. Yeah. Oh, that sounds terrible. I remember one time I was helping to teach a class at the university, an English class. It was actually, to be fair, these were people who were getting like their degree in teaching, mm-hmm. and then they were just getting the specialty in English so that they would have the certificate that would allow them to teach grammar school in English.
Yes.
But their level wasn't really that high. And so this was a writing exercise, and they had all turned in their papers, and I was at home sort of going over them with a red pen and correcting them. And I was completely puzzled by this one essay in which I think it was a guy, I think it was a boy who was in the class. He said, you know, he gave some examples, and then he said, overcoat. I also believe that. And I thought, overcoat? That is so strange. And it turned out that, so if you want to say like, above all, in Spanish you would say, sobre todo. Well, it turns out, as you know, you're nodding at me as I tell you this story. You can say sobre todo as like, what would that be? An adverb, a linking word. But in Spanish, it's also a noun. Would that just be one word if you say un sobre todo?
Yeah, when you refer to the clothing, it's just one.
Yes. Yeah. So it turns out that an overcoat is called un sobre todo, at least in Spain, I guess. I don't know if it's like that in other Spanish-speaking countries. And so he had done some, you know, quick Google search or something and had said, overcoat. There are a gajillion.
Babel fish or.
So exactly. A gajillion stories that we could tell along these lines, but I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap it up for now.
Okay.
I'm so glad that you could join us, and I really hope you'll come back again.
It's been a pleasure.
It has been a pleasure. Next time on Listen, we'll be joined by Lidia Muñoz Solera, a translator and interpreter who's currently teaching German in Burgos, Spain. Hope you can join us. Listen is sponsored by RAF, cutting-edge cuisine in a traditional setting. For a look at the RAF dining experience, visit www.rafsanpedro.es. That's www.rafsanpedro.es. The producers of Listen are Lauren Lovett and Laura Muñoz Solera. Our technical director and engineer is Iñaki Martinez, with original music by Lucas Muñoz Jetmore. I'm Kate Jetmore, and this is Listen. We'll be right back.